Hello and welcome to Uncle Steve's Iron Maiden Zone. I am your host, Uncle Steve, and today I have a brand new Iron Maiden story from you all the way from Australia. On the line with me, I have the one and only, some people might know him as Metal Kevin, but I have Bill Peters from the Music from a Lifetime podcast, and he lives in Albion Park, New South Wales. Bill, how are you, sir?
I'm terrific, Steve, and I can only tell you how much it is a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, we owe it all to Matt, because Matt introduced all of us to you from, gosh, probably a year, 2 years maybe, and then Kirsty got on board. And then, you know, we don't really listen to anything Matt says, but once Kirsty starts getting on board with something, then we have to take it a little seriously. So,
well, see, I always knew there was one person out there listening to the podcast, and now I know who it was.
It was Matt.
It's Matt.
Matt only counts as a half, though, because he's half Aussie and like half American now, I think. So,
yeah, that's an interesting combination, that one.
But, you know, for the longest time, I always thought he was saying music for a lifetime, but, you know.
So well, they're all very similar.
Gotcha. Let me ask you a question. First off, right about Matt. Let me ask you about Matt. You're from Australia. When you hear Matt talk, do you hear an Australian guy or do you hear a watered-down Australian accent?
No. Very, very much Australian. First thing you pick up on it, as soon as I hear him talking, it's still that very strong Australian accent.
Okay, very good.
He hasn't been converted yet. That's very good.
he thinks he has, so I guess now you're confirming his the opposite of what he thinks. So
very correct.
Good. Very good. Very good. Well, let me say this before we get going here, and I haven't even said this. Usually, I say this first thing I talk to somebody. I appreciate you sending your story in, because without somebody that's sending a story in, then there's no conversation happening right now. And a lot of people think we discussed this a minute ago, you know, my story is not good enough, or, you know, it's not interesting enough, or maybe it's, you know, it's just whatever. But in my personal opinion, the reason I do this is because I think everybody's story is worthy of being told, regardless of if it involves riding an airplane with Bruce or whether it involves, hey, I went to some Iron Maiden concerts and I listened to Iron Maiden. So thank you for taking the time to send your story in and to taking the time to talk to me.
As I said, it's my pleasure. And I agree. I think all stories, there's something in there that someone will find interesting. Mm-hmm. Whether that happens today, of course, is another matter altogether. But everyone's story, there's something interesting for someone out there. So it'll be interesting to see what people think.
Oh yeah, I think I've read it and it's definitely interesting to me. So and I could definitely relate with a lot of it too. So I'll start off asking you some questions here and we'll see what we got. Well, you know what? Let me say this other thing first, because starting off, I mentioned that you do have a podcast, Music from a Lifetime podcast. Real quick, if you don't mind, why don't you tell people like where they can find you and kind of what your podcast is?
Okay, so Music from a Lifetime grew out of the blog that I was doing at the same thing for about 15, 20 years. So I just started reviewing albums and writing down in blog form. And then we came to COVID and I sort of had a bit more time at home and I always wanted to sort of try a podcast. I'd tried a couple of different ways beforehand, but I wanted to do a music podcast. So I decided to convert the blog to a podcast. And the way I do it, you can only find on Spotify, which I know for some people is unfortunate. They mightn't have Spotify, but I do it so that the songs that I use in the episodes, when you listen to the episode on Spotify, then you hear the song, and so the artist gets their royalty for that as well. So I'm very much for supporting artists in that way. I know it's a very small amount they get paid, but for me that always worked the best. So Music from a Lifetime is reviews of albums that most of them I own, some I don't, and it's just music from my life, and I do it on the anniversary of the date of their release, so it might be the 20th anniversary, the 25th anniversary, the 30th anniversary, and I guess that's about the best explanation I've got.
Okay, one other question about your you said you're exclusively on Spotify now. Joe Rogan is also exclusively on Spotify. You getting any of that Joe Rogan kind of money over there or what?
Oh, is there any way we could transfer some of that to me? I'd be very happy. No, much like all of us, Steve, I'd do it for the love.
Yeah, I tell you what, man, I would go exclusively to Spotify if I could get some of that Joe Rogan money.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's good. That's good stuff. So first question for you. When you were growing up, and let me just say, there is I don't know if it's a massive thunderstorm going on where I live, but I keep seeing lightning out the window, so hopefully it doesn't derail our call.
Well, that'll be interesting.
That would be terrible. So, when you were growing up, living at home as a kid, like what kind of music, or do you remember hearing music growing up in your house?
Yeah, my parents both had their own music listening artists and albums. The main thing that I had in my house was my mother used to listen to the radio at home, and she would have a cassette in the stereo, and when a song came on that she wanted, she would record it. So she would record her own mixtapes from the radio consistently, and then that's what we'd listen to in the car when we went on trips. So
cool.
I got a lot of popular music at the time on mixed cassettes, so I got a wide-ranging variety of artists. And that's my main memory of being a kid, getting that kind of upbringing in music. Dad would listen to artists like he had Bad Outta Hell by Meatloaf. He listened to Brian Ferry. My mother, they listened to the Eagles. Okay. The Beatles were obviously very big too. But they also had Kris Kristofferson and Johnny Cash and Tom T. Hall. So there was at home, from my parents, there was a pretty big variety of music.
Gotcha.
And most of the time, I must admit, I growing up, one of my main memories up until probably my mid-teens was every Sunday night here in Australia on our local radio station, we used to get the American Top 40 with Casey Kasem.
Yeah.
And so every Sunday night from 4 till 8, I would listen to the American Top 40 and listen to Casey Kasem and do the same thing, do mixtapes and take the songs that I wanted to hear and then have those mixtapes for myself.
It's funny because that means we probably listened to some of the exact same shows at the exact same time from the opposite part of the world.
I would suggest that would be correct.
I know I was doing that too. So listening to him and recording stuff off the radio, you know, that's cool. Yep. Very cool. So fast forwarding a good ways here. Well, maybe a good ways. When do you remember? And I've got an email from this guy, so I know the answers to these questions, and I've got them highlighted because there's some pretty cool stuff here. So tell me the very first time you ever remember hearing Iron Maiden.
Righto. Well, the first time I heard Iron Maiden was actually at an end-of-year school camp when I was 15. So in Australia, it was end of year 10, so I guess it would be the end of junior high in an American sense.
Okay.
And we went away for a week camp for the end of school. And on the last night, they had a talent night where people would get up and either tell a story or do a skit or whatever it was. And four or five of my mates actually got up and they decided to play air guitar or air band guitar sort of stuff. And they mimed out Run to the Hills, which one of my friends had started listening to Iron Maiden again, he claims, and they decided to do that. So they mimed Run to the Hills, and it just went down an absolute treat at the camp. So I got back, and this one of my best friends, who was actually best man at his wedding, and he was the best man at mine, actually.
Yeah.
I wasn't the best man at his wedding. That's a lie. I forgot that. He was the best man at my wedding.
Maybe you were the best man there, but you just weren't his best man.
Well, perhaps. I don't know about that either. But as it turns out, he's the guy who I ended up on my podcast calling my heavy metal music dealer, because he's the guy who had all the music, because his father was very much into bands like Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin and all those kind of bands. So I went to him the next week at school and I said, you need to take me this band that you did the other night. So he went home and he recorded Powerslave for me, because that was – he said, start with this. It's their most recent album. So Powerslave, I think, had been out for about a year at that stage.
Okay.
So I went home and I listened to Powerslave, and the next day I came back with another cassette and I said, you better tape me something else. And so he taped me Peace of Mind. And school finished and we had our six-week Christmas New Year break here in Australia, and I listened to those two tapes for the whole 6 weeks that we were off school. They just went around and around and around. And never looked back, really, after that. But, yeah. I mean, before this, I'd listened to bands like The Police and Queen, Midnight Oil, In Excess.
Okay.
But this was the time where heavy metal took over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I understand that. Now, okay, so at this time, something really weird had happened near where you live in a little small venue. And I think this is really interesting. It's one of those, it's like a gut punch when you find out kind of event. So
yeah, every time I think about it, actually.
So a few months before you got into Iron Maiden, what happened near you?
Well, and I still remember this, and I really do kick myself about it. So about 6 months before that particular camp, there's a club over here at Shell Harbour, and Iron Maiden decided to play at it on their Live After Death tour, the Powerslave tour. And this club honestly holds no more than 1,000 people. It was nondescript, but it's where a lot of the local bands would play and the Australian bands would come and play. And I remember my heavy metal music dealer had actually came to school the next day, and he'd sort of said, oh, I drove past Shell Harbour Workers Club the other day, and he said, I saw this sign at the front saying Iron Maiden tour. He said, I used to like them. And then we didn't think anything more of it until then Live After Death came out 6 months later. And if you look, if you've got Live After Death and you go down and you look, I think it's in May 85, and it says the place is listed as Wollongong, but it's actually Shell Harbour, and it's Shell Harbour Workers Club. So Iron Maiden played 10 minutes away from where I live 6 months before I even listened to Iron Maiden.
You said May of 85.
I think it's May 85.
Oh, it's in the book, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Oh, man, we're going to take a look real fast here. I may have to edit this for a second, but let's see here. I'm looking at these days. I just want to see what it says in this book. I know you told me what it says. I'll be honest, man, the thought of seeing 1985 era Iron Maiden in a club. That just the thought of that is incredible.
Yeah. Okay. It was basically a small club. It was nondescript, and I don't even know how they decided to play there, to be honest, but they definitely did.
Yeah, it says a Wollongong, and it says a Shell Harbour. Is that what you said?
That's it. Yep,
wow.
That's correct.
Golly.
So the Shell Harbour Workers Club.
That's insane. Just a band that's selling out arenas worldwide.
Yep.
Playing
They sold out four nights at Long Beach Arena and recorded Live After Death there, and they played at this little club in Shell Harbour on the same tour.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Oh, man. Okay. So, and who it must be the worst for, though, is your friend that actually said, I drove by and saw that they were playing, and I just kept going.
I love it. I hope he listens to this, because it was exactly what he said. And the thing with him is he'd listened to Iron Maiden prior to this. He had Number of the Beast and he'd listened to that. But then he'd sort of gone off Iron Maiden and was listening to other stuff. And so at that time, he wasn't really listening to Iron Maiden.
What's your friend's name?
Jason Kieran.
Jason Kieran, you should be ashamed of yourself. Jason Kieran, you will from now forth, henceforth be known as, wow, just what, a big dummy? I mean, for not doing that? Oh, my God. He should have at least stopped and just said, let me see if that's real. Let me see if that's the same band. Anything.
I'm sure he's questioned himself every day for the 40 years since.
Well, you know, and funny enough, okay, there's a story I'm about to ask you about and where people made fun of you for something, but somebody drove by, someone drove by a 1,000-seat club and had the opportunity to see Power Slave era Iron Maiden in that club and kept driving. Oh, wow. And then he ended up being back into Maiden a little while later. That has to be the biggest gut punch for him.
Well, that's the thing, because I reckon it would have only been like 2 or 3 months later that he started listening to them again seriously, so... Yeah, that's a poor period of time there. Bit of a brain fade.
Yeah. Jason Kieran, you said. Jason Kieran. That's it. If anybody out there besides my man Bill here knows Jason Kieran, tell him, go ask him about it. Just ask him about it.
Oh, please do.
Okay, so now, so let's get onto a story, I guess, where he makes fun of you a little bit. Where
absolutely he does, yes.
So, yeah, you had a what was a, called a C90 cassette, which basically means it's a 90-minute cassette, got 45 on each side, which were the good, those were the good ones.
That's exactly right. You had to get the C90 so you could get two albums on them rather than one and a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had one side, I don't know what was on, I can't remember what you said was on one side, but on one side you had Somewhere in Time, but there wasn't quite enough room to get all of Somewhere in Time, so you had to make an editing decision.
And this is exactly right, because I think Somewhere in Time goes for 50 minutes, or someone can correct me if that's wrong, but it's about 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So the C90 cassette, we had this discussion one day at school about, oh, well, you've got to leave one song off in order to fit all the other songs on completely on this one side of a C90 cassette. So most of my friends sort of said, oh, well, we'll leave Deja Vu off and we'll have all the rest on there. And I sort of thought, oh, yeah. And I said, only because I'd worked out how long all the songs were and not for distinguishing my love or hate of any particular songs, I've said, well, if you take Sea of Madness off, it fits perfectly. Now, of course, my friend group then started throwing things at me because they took it as to me as saying that I hate Sea of Madness, which
of course
is absolutely ludicrous, and I continue to say that to this day. But for the last, 37 years now since that incident, I continually be told by the same friends that, oh, remember when Bill said he hates Sea of Madness? And that still doesn't sit very well with me, I'll be honest.
Well, let me ask you, if you had to consider the two things, which one would sit worse with you in your gut? Missing an Iron Maiden show where they played a 1,000-seat club on the Power Slave tour, or just being falsely accused of not liking an Iron Maiden song? I mean, come on.
I think that's a very easy question to answer, Steve.
Maybe we should ask your friend Jason.
I'll make sure to ask him next time I see him.
Yeah, with the tag. We'll put Jason Kieran. Kieran? Is that how you said it?
Yes.
It'll be a hashtag Jason Kieran on this episode. That's funny. So, but you told me you had put some B-sides to make up for the extra space, right?
I solved the problem by going for Somewhere in Time. I just got a C60 cassette, which is a 60-minute cassette for anyone who doesn't know what cassettes are.
Yeah, right.
And so what I did, because I also at the same time bought the Wasted Years 12-inch single. And on the B-side to that is the two great songs I still love, Reach Out and Sheriff of Huddersfield. So I actually put Somewhere in Time on the C60, and then there's just enough space on the halfway through the second side to put those two songs on, and it pretty much fits 60 minutes perfectly. So I think it cuts through, if I remember correctly, it was I think it cuts the Loneliest of the Long Distance Runner somewhere halfway between the song. I've got to change the side of the cassette to do it. So
oh man, that's funny.
Which, you know, people, it, these were real world problems back in 1986 and 1987. You know, these days people have stream or they've got CDs and all this kind of stuff. This is a real world problem. If you wanted to listen to music on a cassette player instead of you bought the vinyl, you can't take that with you anywhere.
Right.
So you had to have it on cassette. So what do? Get rid of a song, or do you have to cut a song halfway through to make it go on the other side? Terrible, terrible decisions we had to make in those days.
Or sometimes you'd have to change the running order.
Correct.
You know, take a song, this song's a little shorter, but if I move it over here and put that one there up here, it makes it fit right, and then that's out of order. And then when you're in the car with somebody else who actually has just the regular thing, and then a song starts, and you're like, whoa, why is that playing there?
That's exactly right.
That's what they used to do on 8-tracks, though.
Yes,
they
would
just
say, yeah.
I never had to use an 8-track, but if you look on running order on, sometimes it'll be like three or four sides, and it's like they just put the tracks wherever they would fit. So it's really bizarre.
Yeah.
So I meant to ask you this, because you got into them around Power Slave, around Live After Death era.
Yes.
So you go back at some point, I guess, and you're hearing at least the first couple of albums at some point, right?
Yeah, so after that Christmas period where I had the two albums, I again went back to school and went back to my heavy metal music dealer, Jason Kieran, and I said, well, I can hear that storm in the background, Stu. That's very close.
Well, it scares me because if my power goes off, then our entire recording is kaput. It's just scary. Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I went back to school and I furnished cassettes again, and I said, well, you need to give me everything Iron Maiden has done up to this point. So I got Iron Maiden, obviously. I got Killers and Maiden Japan, and I got The Number of the Beast.
Okay. And what did you think of Paul Di'Anno when you heard him? Because you were already hearing Bruce.
Yes. To be honest, I always loved, and I still do, love Paul Di'Anno's voice and the music that he made in the band. I mean, for me, and I'm sure it's been said before elsewhere, the music that Iron Maiden made at that time, his voice suited the music and his attitude suited the music. And I love, especially Killers, I think is just fantastic. Wrathchild, Murders in the Rue Morgue, Killers, Purgatory, just fantastic songs. And he just gives them the attitude that they deserve.
Okay.
And also on the Made in Japan live EP, the same thing. I think they were fantastic. So I had no qualms about the fact that it was this different singer and this different guy in those days.
Yeah.
Probably because I got them after the fact, and I was able to just relate the fact that, okay, so we eventually got to Bruce and we've got Bruce now, so that's okay.
Sure. Yeah, and That makes sense. So you got into them on you had Somewhere in Time. You went through the dilemma of your so-called big Iron Maiden fan friend that, you know, skipped an Iron Maiden show that was, you know, I mean, you think about it. Is he really an Iron Maiden fan when you skip a Power Slave show at a club? At a club? I mean, come on.
Well, I guess in the long run, to be fair, he was the same age of me. At the time, we were only 15 years of age. So if he'd been 18 and had the ability to sort of buy the ticket himself and go himself, I guess that's okay. But no, don't stop giving it to him, because I think he deserves it.
Yeah, I'll say this, that I got into Iron Maiden before Somewhere in Time was out. And only in the last couple of years did I find out that Iron Maiden played two shows on the Somewhere in Time tour within an hour of where I lived, within a month of each other. They were doing a U.S. tour, and they played in Dallas. Then they went around other places, came back to like Fort Worth, which is only 30 miles away from Dallas, and played another show. Of course, you know, it was with ex-Kiss guitarist Vinnie Vincent's band opening.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
But the thought of them playing that close when I just became a fan and thinking I could have seen the Somewhere in Time tour, it's a kind of a gut punch when I think about it.
Well, I agree, because after that Power Slave tour, because Iron Maiden toured Australia on Number of the Beast and I think Peace of Mind, and then Power Slave, but they didn't tour again until 1992. So we didn't see the Summer in Time tour, which, you know, would have absolutely killed to. We didn't see them on Seventh Son or, you know, any of those other albums. So at a time when we were going like 16, 17, 18 years of age, right at the height of when we wanted to see this band, we couldn't, because in Australia we're too far away for anyone to tour. We were at that time anyway.
So, okay, so the next album came out with Seventh Son, and you're at this point, you're probably a huge, huge fan. So what do you think when Seventh Son comes out?
Loved it. Yeah. I was at uni, not doing very well, not having much of time. This album came out, and it didn't leave my car for months. It was just from the – I remember on a late-night program out here on a music program, there was a one-hour documentary that came out before the album did. Mm-hmm. On the making of the album, and I've looked for it forever since, and I can't find it anywhere. And it was just fantastic, and that sort of whetted the appetite. And then when the album came out, I was just in love with it. I'd constantly gone through each of the albums, just thinking, oh, this one, nothing can beat that, and then, oh no, this has nothing can beat that. Oh, the next one comes out, well, that's pretty hard, isn't it?
Sure.
And it was this. It was the same with Seventh Son. It was just. And it all fit together so well in the way it's recorded, obviously, and with the storyline and all that kind of stuff. But, everything about it I just thought was fantastic.
Okay. And then, so in the interim between those two between the next album and that one, you had Adrian Smith exiting the band. So when you when you find out Adrian exits the band, do you think anything of it, or is it just kind of like, okay, as long as Maiden keeps going on, what are your thoughts?
I thought a lot about it, actually, because always loved Adrian's songwriting more than anything else. I just thought he was just a fantastic songwriter. And, of course, he'd sung on that B-side, Reach Out, which I love because the fact he sings it as well. So I thought a lot about it. In fact, so much so that I went out and bought his album, his Adrian Smith and Project album, which is Silver and Gold, which I bought that at the time. And made myself love it, even though it was so completely different from anything that he'd done in Maiden.
Yeah.
And I was actually listening to it today, just before I got on with you, just to refresh my memory and see if I love it any more than I did then. And the answer is no. But that, I mean, that to me, listening to that album showed the divergence in the direction the two were going. And you can see why Adrian left if you listen to that album, because that album is so different from what Maiden were doing. Obviously, with the next album, they went down with a much more stripped-down sound, and Adrian wasn't looking for that at all. But I do – one of the things that I think of when I listen to Seventh Son, and then I know at the time Adrian – wanted to continue in that direction and go in that almost sort of prog metal sort of way. It's almost to me, obviously, and then Bruce left not long after that, and then they went through a different period. It's almost as though when you get to Brave New World, which I'm sure we'll do, that is almost the next album after Seventh Son. Well, if you put Seventh Son and then Brave New World, there's almost a direct correlation between the way the music sounds for me, on Brave New World, that comes sort of – it's a much more direct route than, say, what they did with No Prayer for the Dying.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense when you say – I've never thought of it that way, but that definitely makes sense. What did you think of when you heard – like when you heard No Prayer, like what was your – because it was a lot different.
It was, and I think – more than anything else, just my blinding love of Iron Maiden made me miss things initially. I just listened to it and thought, oh, it's another Iron Maiden album. It's just great. Everything's great about it. I love it, all that kind of thing. And listened to it for, you know, the 6 months that I did, I guess. And it was when I came back to it, I guess, maybe whatever, you know, when I had a break from it, I came back. And then I suddenly thought, oh, okay, yeah, it's different. Yeah, that's not quite what I expect now. But
yeah.
I know initially, the obvious difference in the way the music was written and played. I still loved it as much, but I guess, you know, in retrospect, Seventh Son is the end of the first great era of Iron Maiden, and for me, I should say, it's, it's not generalized a thing.
Sure.
And that what came next for the next 12 years was different, and I think, which I believe with a lot of Iron Maiden stuff, is that, and I would probably use this statement more than anything else, that even, and I'm not suggesting that No Prayer is an average album, don't get me wrong, but even an average Iron Maiden album is going to be better than just about any other album you listen to. And I truly believe that. So No Prayer was different, and like I said, loved it without thinking about it. And then when I came back to it, I still loved most of it, but probably not all of it.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, hindsight for me has been like that. Like, you know, whenever it came out, like whenever I heard Adrian wasn't in the band, I don't remember even thinking, see, I didn't recognize like, oh yeah, he was a great songwriter and his soloing, blah, 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 whatever. It was just like, I was like, okay, they're making a new album. He's not on it. Great. Who cares? And then, you know, then I got that one and I didn't like nowadays I look back and I go, oh yeah, I can definitely tell the shift in where they were going from Somewhere in Time to Seventh Son to, wow, this is a big, and it's basically their, like they were going back to the Killers thing, you know?
Yes.
That kind of rawer sound, which...
Yep.
And so they did that, and then they went to... the next album they did was Fear of the Dark.
Yep.
Which was... I don't remember what I thought of it back then, but I know I went and saw the tour. It didn't... I wasn't like... To me, I think I probably just thought it was another Iron Maiden album. I didn't even notice, wow, Bruce is real raspy. It was just another Iron Maiden album. What did you think when Fear of the Dark was out, when it came out?
Yeah, that was the first time that I'd had reservations about Iron Maiden. I hadn't had it with No Prayer for the Dying. In retrospect, that might be a different thing, but Fear of the Dark, for me, just had some elements of it that just, to me, I just sort of thought, well, this is a bit weak. And sure. I hadn't ever thought about that, about an Iron Maiden album or tracks to that point in time.
Yeah.
And I think, and especially on the episode you did recently in comparing the two albums, and I thought, which I loved, I thought was fantastic. That was a really good conversation because in a lot of ways you realised how weak those two albums were. For whatever reason, whether it was because Adrian left and we didn't have his songwriting, whether it was because Bruce was fed up and he wanted to do something else, which, you know, I think everyone after they'd listened to Tattooed Millionaire sort of thought, well, is Bruce doing the same thing as Adrian? He wants to go down a different track.
Sure.
So they obviously weren't on the same wavelength when it came to that kind of stuff. So the most exciting thing about Fear of the Dark for me was it was going to be the first time I saw Iron Maiden, which is what I did on that tour as well. And just to put the icing on the cake about how ambivalent I am about Fear of the Dark, I saw them at the Horden Pavilion in Sydney, and the sound that night was the worst sounding concert I've ever been to. And I don't know what the sound engineers and all those boys were on that night, because it was terrible. It was echoey. You couldn't hear parts of, you know, I had to move or force my way all the way up to the front to within five rows of the front to actually feel like I could hear everything perfectly. And that was terrible. Dave Murray played with a broken leg. He'd broken his leg, I think, in Melbourne. So he had his right leg in plaster right up to his hip. And he stood on stage and he still played everything, but he couldn't jump around. He couldn't move around.
Yeah.
He had to have been in pain. Mind you, Yannick was jumping off Marshall stacks and doing things like that. So that sort of did that. But it was – we walked out and it was such a downer because the sound had been so bad. They played songs like – I will not say hate, but I dislike immensely Wasting Love. I dislike that song so much. Mm-hmm. And I cannot believe, firstly, that they put that on an Iron Maiden album. That's what killed Fury of the Dark for me. Okay. That Iron Maiden would put a song like that on that album.
Yeah.
Because it's a B-side at best. And then they played it live on the tour as well. And I just thought, ugh.
Yeah.
I might sound too harsh. Sorry, I don't mean to. But that, for me at the time, like first time seeing Iron Maiden, the album coming out on wasn't great.
Yeah.
There was some other stuff going on as well at the time. It was just a really bizarre experience.
Yeah, you know, when I think back to how I felt about that album back then, I don't remember like thinking it was amazing. I don't remember thinking it was terrible. But what vague recollection I have was that I listened to it some, and then it just was kind of not really on the radar. You know,
yep.
There was too much stuff coming out, because that's the same year. Like think Fear of the Dark came out the same year that Dirt by Alice in Chains came out. I mean, there's such a huge contrast. And, you know,
one's a brilliant album, the other one isn't.
One's a brilliant album, the other one's Fear of the Dark.
That's right, exactly.
So, you know, and there are things like, but I think, yeah, I mean, now all these years later, when I started the podcast and I even was like, I knew that's the album that's garbage to me by Iron Maiden, if I'm going to call one that, you know. I mean,
yes.
There are some very high points on it, of course. But there's also the lowest lows are on that album, in my opinion. Some of the lowest lows. So
I'll still go back to the statement I made before, which is an average Iron Maiden. It will still be better than most other albums.
Yeah.
But that one in particular is a very tough call.
I'd rather listen to that than a Poison album, you know.
Well, that's...
I mean, you know, I can say that. That's not a big compliment or anything. But
no, that's right. You're not really judging it against much there.
So I meant to ask you this too, so because you brought it up. What did you think when Tattooed Millionaire came out?
Yeah. I was surprised. There are still a couple of songs on there that I like.
Sure.
But it wasn't what we expected. It wasn't what you and we discussed earlier, Paul Stanley's solo album.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same sort of thing. Like when that came out, when I first heard that, I was expecting this great, big, grandiose album that was going to be one of the greatest albums ever because it's Paul Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's not. Tattooed Millionaire was the same. I just thought, well, this is going to be great. He's going to come out with all these great ideas. It's going to be heavy. It's going to be whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It's fun enough. Like if I'm in the right mood, I can put it on and just listen to it and think, yeah, okay, that's fun enough. But it's not what I expected. And it's interesting that Bruce decided to leave Iron Maiden to go and do more. At the time, we were saying, what, he's going to go do more Tattooed Millionaire? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I know. I remember... Well, I can say this because by the time this comes out, this will have already been done. But I listened to Tattooed Millionaire earlier this week. And I remember at one point a song started playing and I honestly had no idea what it was because I skipped it so much back then. And there's about three or four songs that are like that. I mean, I vaguely recognize when they start and I'm like, but
was it Zulu Lulu?
Yes. I, as much as I crap on that song, like it literally, when it started playing in my mind, I was going like, which song is this? I don't even know what it is. And then it finally got to a point where I realized what song it was. And I was just like, how does Matt like this song? But you know, something else, and I will probably say this on an episode that's going to be done. And, in the next couple weeks, there's a line on, Balls to Picasso, the song Sacred Cowboys. There's a song that says, you can sell people crap and make them eat it.
Yep.
And in my mind, I thought, you can sell people crap and make them eat it. I thought, selling the crap, I thought, the seller of the crap, Matt, the crap, Zulu Lulu, trying to make people eat it, you know? He keeps trying to feed that to people like it's this great thing. But yeah, when it started, I honestly was like, What song is this? Like, I just didn't even... And I thought... But I remember listening to that album back in the day, and I would listen to Son of a Gun and Tattooed Millionaire. Then I would flip the cassette over, and I would listen to No More Lies.
Yes.
Yep. And now I'll say now, after a full listen of it, like I say, Gypsy Road is okay. It's not a bad song. Mm-hmm. I can appreciate it as an older guy. I love Born in 58 now. Like, I used to not like it, but I like the big chorus. I think Son of a Gun's probably the best song on the album. I don't like the song No More Lies anymore. That one. and pretty much, like, I hate All the Young Dudes. But when I listened to it the other day, I thought, but this song is like a masterpiece compared to Zulululu, you know? So, but yeah, it's so here's another question, like kind of fast forwarding a little bit. So Bruce went solo and I've talked to a lot of people that said that when he went solo, they weren't interested because of how bad they thought Tattooed was, and they didn't want to hear anything else if that was what he was going to put out. Were you in that same ballpark, or did you know, like when Balls came out, were you interested?
Yeah, not at that time. Actually, I didn't even know Balls to Picasso had come out when it did, and I was working in Sydney at the time, and a customer came in who knew I listened to metal. He said, "Oh, have you heard Bruce's new album?" I said, "Didn't know he had one out." So the next day he actually brought it in for me.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, this is better.
Yeah, so, same here.
That was good. And then I got Skunkworks when it came out, and that was it was probably a bridge too far for me at the time.
Sure.
It didn't fit well with me, so I from then I just thought, oh, well, I don't know what he's going to do, and obviously at the time it sounds like he didn't know what he was going to do either.
Yeah, right.
So as it turns out, I ended up initially missing out on Accident of Birth, and I was back in my hometown in Kiama, and one of my best mates had to take me in the car somewhere, and he said, "Listen to this," and he put this CD in the car, and so we've got the opening of King in Crimson off The Chemical Wedding.
Yeah.
And he just said, "Listen to the riff." And I said, "Oh, that sounds really good." And he said, "Well, listen to the vocals first." And then when I heard it, and I said, "Is that who I think it is?
Holy crap, what is this?"
And he said, "Yes, it is." And so then we played the whole album, and I just said, "Far out, have I missed anything else?" So then I had to go back and get Accident of Birth and discovered, yes, I have absolutely missed something there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my Bruce travels. It's
sure. Yeah,
Tattooed Millionaire sense. Didn't turn me off Balls to Picasso. Skunkworks was very difficult for me at the time. Mm-hmm. I listen to it now without any problems, but at the time it just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And then I really wished I'd got Accident of Birth at the time because I missed 2 years of listening to it.
Yeah, yeah. I was fortunate enough. I saw him live with that. Like I was right up front at the stage, you know, with Bruce up there, with Adrian over to my right, and just being in my, and I didn't even know he did ASAP. I didn't know anything. I was just like, Adrian left Iron Maiden, and now it's 1998, and holy crap, he's standing over to my right. He's over there. Oh my God, it's Adrian Smith, you know?
See, if there's one thing that my friends and I say about living in America, there's only one thing that we miss, and that's seeing concerts like that, because we just don't get them in Australia, and that's changed a lot in recent years. But you know, to be able to see Bruce Dickinson live on either of those tours would have been mind blowing.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was like I remember I was right up front, and it was wild, you know, just to think that that's, you know, like I remember, you know, being right there, and I'm trying to find a picture that I took, because I found them and I sent them to Matt and Kirsty one day. So I'll see if I can find them while we're talking, and I'll send them in the Skype chat if I can find them.
Jeez, but you're not winning any friends here, Steve, having photos of it as well, you know.
It's, you know, of all the shows I went to back in the day, though, it's like I wish, you know how everyone goes to shows nowadays and they have their, you know, they record everything and they've got cameras and all that good stuff. And you're just like, I so wish, you know, people annoy you. I wish they would turn that off and they wouldn't be doing this and that. And but look at your screen.
Yeah, you're killing me.
You see, I probably have hold on, another one for you. Let's see, where's my Skype little thing here? I don't mean this in any derogatory way, but I mean, this is just how close I was.
Yes.
Should be
it's a cool thing.
There should be another one popping up here shortly. Let's see here. I'll send another one. And then I'll stop. I think that's all I've got is about.
Yeah, right.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite one right there.
That's fantastic.
Oh, and I'll show you. I'll send you one other picture that has nothing to do with Iron Maiden, but it's about a band that we talked about earlier. So you'll know who it is when you see him. It's old ass picture. If you can see,
right.
Tom Kiefer.
That's great. Yep. Yeah. So it is.
So, wow. But yeah, but seeing a lot of people have told me that, and I remember when Balls to Picasso came out, and I was just kind of like, okay, you know, that was the first thing that came out, because it came out before The X Factor did.
Yes, it did, yeah.
And, you know, I remember seeing it, and I remember getting it, and, you know, like, you know, you're wondering, is it going to be Tattooed Millionaire again? But I remember as soon as it came on, and Bruce starts singing, and it's guitars, and I was just like, oh, man, he's good. He's back to hard rock again. And
yep, exactly right. Yep.
And then Skunk Works was weird.
It was.
But I still liked it. Like, I listened to it this week, and I went through all of his albums this past week, and I was really impressed with how much I did like it, but, okay, so.
Yeah, I like it now. Yeah. Yeah, but at the time, it was, again, it was too different. I think in my head, Bruce is going down a different path again. I don't have to worry about it anymore, but sure. That was probably what I was thinking.
Yeah. So you saw the Fear of the Dark show, and then pretty sure that, you know, I don't know if you knew that no pun intended, that the writing was on the wall for Bruce at that point, but soon enough, he was gone. And when you found out he was gone, they hired Blaze. Those two things, did you know who Blaze was? What did you think when Bruce left?
Yeah, I did. I'd listened to some Wolfsbane. And I knew that Steve thought highly of him. I remember at the time there was a rumor that circulated that, you know, we were sort of excited about, was that because at the same time Michael Kiske had yeah. left Helloween, uh-huh. and there was some talk that perhaps Michael Kiske was going to come in and sing for Iron Maiden, mm-hmm. and I don't think that would have worked, especially seeing as Michael Kiske had no interest in metal, which is why he left Helloween mm-hmm. and went on his 20-year sabbatical or whatever it was. But, yeah, so I'd heard Wolfsbane, and I knew of Blaze. The thing with Wolfsbane is, for me, is that to me it just sounds like it's a Van Halen parody. There's some of their songs just sound so much like Van Halen. I think, was that a deliberate thing, or was it just something that happened? Because I don't think there's any need for that. So I must admit, when he was announced as a singer, I just thought, oh, I don't know how this is going to go. Mm-hmm. And I'll be interested to hear it and see how it turns out.
So what did you think?
When I first got the X Factor and I put it on, and they've got the really low starting bit of Sign of the Cross, and I went to my stereo and I thought, have I got this on? Has this started? It looks like it's been going for 2 minutes. I can't hear anything. And so I think I just got to the volume and turned it up just as it went bang into the and it just sort of bang and blew me back, and I thought, oh well, okay, we've started.
Yeah.
And I thought the album was terrific in a different way, and it wasn't sure. It wasn't an immediate love of the album. There were some tracks that immediately caught me, which I think is fairly standard. And generally, at the start, it was the first half of the album that drew me in, and then the back half of the album, I sort of thought, oh, there's a bit too much sort of dwell, you know, the slow starts and the slow ends and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I didn't hate it, yeah. And I didn't love it, but I enjoyed parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, then over time, over probably the next 12 months, I grew to... I still don't want to use love as that word. I like it a lot, yeah. And I have ever since.
Yeah.
We all know a change of mood in this album. And I have friends who didn't enjoy it and don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And they just sort of said, well, there's no Bruce, there's no Adrian, why would I listen to it? And I sort of, my answer to that was, Steve Harris is still writing the majority of the songs, and he's the band's songwriter. So
right.
there's got to be something there for you to get involved in.
Yeah.
But a definite changing of the mood. Where there wasn't a lot of upbeat stuff, apart from Man on the Edge, I guess, and
Lord of the Flies,
that like the two sort of single type songs were the ones that really sort of picked up the pace a bit. The rest of it took a lot of time to get used to.
Gotcha. Yeah. I remember hearing it back then, and I was going through a weird phase of life too. You know, you get a little older, and you kind of not necessarily priorities changing, but just what you're doing in life. You know, your full time job, living on your own, and you know, it's just you don't. Life isn't exactly the same as it is when you're at home and you're in your bedroom and you can just, you have no responsibilities. And so, but you know, it was definitely a lot different than what they did before. And you got a completely different type of vocalist. And I think that was very calculated on Steve Harris's part. I think he wanted the farthest thing away. And this is something I thought about in the last few months. I figure in his mind, he thought, I'm not going to get anybody that sounds like Bruce, because if I do that, Bruce will be out there saying, oh, yeah, look, they had to go get someone just like me. Of course he did.
Yes.
Because they famously may not get along very well. And then, of course, Steve goes out and gets another guy like that, and then Bruce is probably sitting around going, yeah, it's not going to work because he doesn't sound like me, you know. But either way, I mean, I respect Steve for doing that, because Rob Halford left Priest a few years later. They went and got a clone of, you know, which I like Ripper Owens, but they went and got someone like that. And what did the fans do? It's not Rob Halford. He sucks. You know, it wouldn't have mattered what they did. If you lose the iconic of iconic, which is Rob Halford and Bruce Dickinson, there is no replacing those guys, really. So
I think that's a really interesting comparison too, because to me, and I both of Blaze's albums I like, and I love all of Blaze's solo stuff. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
The only problem they had bringing Blaze Bayley into the band as the lead singer was not the albums, but it was the live shows.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't do Bruce's stuff live. You listen to him trying to sing 2 Minutes to Midnight on live bootlegs and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to handle. and that's what I think was the main problem for Iron Maiden, is that live wise,
sure.
he could sing all his stuff he was doing, but he couldn't do the old Bruce stuff. With Judas Priest, they bring in a clone to sing all of Rob Halford's stuff, which works brilliantly live. I saw them twice with him.
Oh, lucky.
As lead singer, and he was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I've seen him a couple of times out here on just single gigs doing his old stuff. But the problem was that when they did the two albums, Jugulator and Demolition, they did slow songs, slow sort of almost alternative metal songs, instead of doing what they were doing on Painkiller, which is what Ripper would have just loved to have done and would have excelled at.
Yeah.
So I think that's where Judas Priest made their mistake there. But, you know, I'm a mug punter. I wouldn't know what I'm talking about. But that's what always got me about those two Judas Priest albums. They had the guy who could sing it, but they didn't give him the material to showcase it.
Yeah, I've heard it said that, you know, Steve Harris could have down-tuned a bit for Blaze. And I think that, like, you're right. That's where he didn't think about, how's this going to work live? He just thought, yeah, we can make this work. And so,
I think you're right. Wasn't there a story that they said they weren't going to down-tune no matter who it was? And, I mean, surely that's just a simple thing to do live and give the guy a chance.
Yeah, I don't know enough about music to know, but, I mean, I think it's basically just tuning, you know, playing something, everything, they'll say half a step down, like when, you know, like if it's an A, you're playing just whatever. But yeah, I don't... It would have been interesting to hear, because, I mean, I think that's what Blaze does. Every now and then he'll play an old Maiden song. And I heard a version of him, Matt sent me a version one time where he had done Wasted Years. Blaze had done it. And it was down-tuned a little bit. And it was really, really good. I was just like, I couldn't believe how good it was, you know, because you hear Blaze and on like saying trying to sing Heaven Can Wait or The Trooper,
yes,
and you're going like,
that's right,
it's rough.
It is pretty tough to take. And it's like me singing those songs.
Wait, Maiden would not have played Australia again. Okay, I know the answer to that. Okay,
yes.
So then eventually, you know, the world comes to find out that Blaze is out and Bruce and Adrian are back. And plus, Yannick is not leaving the band. They're keeping him too. So when you heard about that, like all of those things together, what were your thoughts on all that?
We said, when are they touring Australia? and they didn't.
Oh, man.
That was exciting times. You know what? As much for Bruce, but probably more for Adrian. I think certainly myself and my friends were just as excited for Adrian coming back. Mm-hmm. We just thought that's something that made need. And the fact that they kept Yannick, I think, was fantastic.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Maybe they haven't utilized that well live. I just feel as though they could probably do that better live if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they're all three there, I mean, they all obviously thought they were going to make enough money to cover the extra person, and I'm sure that's the case.
it was
exciting times. And, I mean, we didn't speak about Virtual 11, so we could very quickly just say that, for Virtual 11 for me, I think there's four good songs.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's four above-average songs, and I think there's four awful songs. And it was just proof that the whole Blaze Bailey thing wasn't going to work. And you've got to, as much as it must have been a tough decision, you've got to commend Iron Maiden for realising, or obviously I think it was Rod Smallwood who probably worked it out. They just said, we need to do something here or the whole band's just going to fall apart.
Yeah.
So the fact that they identified that had to be fixed and that they were able to go back to these two guys and say, look, do you want to come back on board and let's try again? It's, 25 years later now and they're still going. So mm-hmm. you can see, and on top of that, Blaze is still doing his stuff on his own, which I still think is great. So I think it was a good decision for everyone involved.
I have heard, and I don't know, I've never seen it confirmed by anybody, and it never will because, you know, English people are, at least in the Maiden camp, they seem to be very, respectful of one another. And
yes,
I've heard it said, though, where two different stories were. One was that Nico was going to leave the band or Yannick was going to leave the band because they were just like, I don't like what we're doing. I don't like the direction. Whatever it was, you know, I don't know. And I've never heard anyone with any real authority say that, but I have heard rumblings of that. And so I don't know, you know, who's what or who said what or if any of it happened. So
you can imagine that being the case. Obviously, I would say that they could see their popularity was falling. They weren't selling as many concert tickets. They weren't selling as many albums. There were probably other things involved in that as well, but they obviously saw the problem was that people just didn't want to see this lineup of the band and they had to do something about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that Rod was managing Bruce and probably Adrian as well. He was probably in Bruce's ear. He was probably in Steve's ear. And, you know, he made that whole thing. Hey, let's just meet up and talk. And
he sounds like, and everything you read about him, he's a master manipulator.
Yeah. So Brave New World comes out. What are you thinking then?
Yeah, you hear the opening strains of the Wicker Man straight away, and you just think, holy crap, Iron Maiden are back.
That was
to me, and when you saw the video and you know, Adrian's playing that opening riff as well, and that was the perfect comeback. You know, Adrian writes the song, he plays the opening riff, mm-hmm. Bruce comes in and does all the Bruce things. Mm-hmm. And again, I guess it's a bit like in the same way, I think, with No Prayer for the Dying. I just loved this album from the start and just thought it was brilliant. Played it for months and months and months. And it wasn't until I came back a second time where I thought, oh, there's a couple of pieces in here that I'm sort of a bit dodgy on. But overall, they don't matter in the whole scheme of the album. I still listen to the album now and just think every song's a winner.
Oh, yeah.
But I know that there are some periods, some of the songs I think maybe stretch a little long or outstay their welcome. Maybe that's just me being old and looking at it that way. But I do recall, like I said, initially, everything about it was just brilliant. And then on the second phase of listening, whenever it was, sort of 12, 18 months later, I thought, I don't love that song as much as I initially did when I heard it. But not to the point that it was detrimental to the album or to the song itself.
Yeah, it's funny because when you mentioned that, like a song overstaying its welcome, and you mentioned on X Factor the same type of thing, the slow starts, the slow ends. It's like I thought what he's describing is basically Iron Maiden right now.
Yes.
Modern day Iron Maiden. That became their formula. So
it did, and it has become, and that's exactly right. And a lot of the times you listen to different songs on all of the albums, you know, from 2000 onwards, and you wonder, do I really need this 2-minute interlude at the start of the song? Can we just get straight stuck into the song, or can we not have this minute interlude at the end of the song? Can we just finish the song? I think Steve Harris's name is written on most of those songs, and it's just the way that he's decided in the second half of his career, that's the way he's going to write.
I gotta admit, man, I'm a big fan of most of the intros and outros. I really like them but I guess it's just part of, you know, who Maiden have become, and I like listening to it. But I do know that there's definitely a section of people that feel that way too. What you're saying, so
I think you're right. It doesn't really affect the songs, and it doesn't affect my enjoyment of the songs. It's just that sometimes I listen to them and think, is it necessary?
Right, I understand.
Can we just get rid of that and make the song, instead of being an 8-minute song, it could be a 5-minute song.
Right. So what did you think when Dance of Death came out? What did you think of that?
Yeah, same thing. Wildest Dreams is interesting, but I think Rainmaker was, along with The Wicker Man, were just the two songs that showcased that Maiden was back. Like, they were just almost like they're radio friendly songs, and I know no one listens to the radio and they don't play Maiden on the radio, but they were the two songs that Maiden said, here we are, we can still write these songs. And they hadn't done that for quite some time. But the great thing about Dance of Death, I think, is the grandiose nature of it. And you've got Passchendaele, of course, and the closing song, whose name I've sadly forgotten.
It's the acoustic one.
That's right. Yeah. I can't remember the name of it, sorry. That's terrible. That's my 54-year-old memory going.
As Matt likes to say, we're fans, not experts. Journeyman.
Journeyman, that's right. So songs like that, and then, of course, Dance of Death itself. You sort of think, well, they're like Maiden did their big songs in the 80s, such as Alexander the Great and Rime of the Ancient Mariner and To Tame a Land. And these sort of songs sort of remind me of the grandiose nature of those songs, not necessarily the same type of songs, but they've just got a body about them that I think is just fantastic. Everyone gets their chance with the guitar. Bruce's lyrics are just fantastic. His vocals, sorry. There are other songs on there as well, like Face in the Sand, which is just an underrated song in the Iron Maiden catalogue. I've just got it now. I've got a shiver down my spine just thinking about that song. Yeah. And every time I hear it, that's what it does. I just think it's fantastic.
You said, though, I want to ask you to elaborate on something for Matt and Kirsty's sake. You did mention that Wildest Dreams was, and the quote, interesting. What's your definition of interesting in that instance?
I think for me, it was the first time I had heard an opening track on an Iron Maiden album that I just thought that was less than great. I do remember when I initially got the album and I listened to the album, and I'm pretty sure that was the single off the first single off the album. And I'm pretty sure I've got the CD single to it, which is an enhanced CD that has the video on it as well. I just thought that it was a str- strange song to open with. It just didn't feel like an opening track of an Iron Maiden album. And then, you know, Rainmaker comes in straight after it, and I forget all about it because Rainmaker, to me, is just so brilliant.
Gotcha.
But I think that to me, after, you know, we had the Wicker Man on the previous album as the opening track, and I guess I was expecting or hoping for another Wicker Man, and I didn't get it.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. I just, when you, the way you said it, I was like, oh, let me, I know, because Kirsty loves it, Matt hates it, so, and I lean more toward Matt's feelings on that one than I do Kirsty, so.
Yeah, you could add me to that list, too.
So the next album came out, Matter of Life and Death.
Mm.
Any thoughts there on that one?
Well, firstly, why is this the only album that doesn't have a live album attached to it?
Yes.
I mean, they played this, didn't come to Australia, mind you, and tour on this tour and play the whole album live. Mm-hmm. But it's the only album that they don't have a live album for, and they played the whole damn album live.
I know.
And every single album since 2000 has got a live album attached to it. I don't understand that. But anyway, that's small.
I seem to have heard that they were set up to record it, and there was a power outage wherever they were set to record. That I don't know if it's true, but there are a couple of good bootlegs on it.
I've got a couple of video bootlegs of it, and also a really good audio one. But
yeah.
You just always sort of think, well, where's that live album?
Would be nice obviously to Rod's, have it.
Yeah, Rod Smallwood with his dollars, surely they could have done that.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Yeah,
I must say, when I first got this album and put it on again, the very progressive side of it initially wore a bit thin, I think, is probably the best way to put it. Okay. It didn't grab me from the start. Okay. I just think the style of the album and the songs wasn't quite what I was looking for, and it was probably that again. You know, when you get to the point where you're expecting an album or you're looking forward to an album, and sometimes you build it up too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you listen to it, there's that disappointment that it doesn't live up to that. And I think with this album especially, I had that initially. So it really took me a long time to get this album and get what it was and get what Maiden were trying to do with it. So my initial feelings were, I just thought, oh, this is only average.
Mm.
But over a period, and it did, I'll be honest, it probably took me 12 months of listening to it on and off.
Yeah.
And it was one of those albums that I actually put on random just to see if it would mix it up for me. And that probably actually worked, because then I started hearing songs in a different way that I hadn't heard by listening to the album from start to finish.
Sure.
And so I did that a little bit and then went back to playing the album in its entirety, and it sort of fell into place more for me.
Okay, that's interesting. I know Kirsty had told me, I can't remember what album she was talking about recently, but she said she was thinking that she didn't like something, and then she put it on random, and she said when a certain song came on, and she was like, whoa, this song's really awesome, and then she realized, oh, it's on that album. This is one of the songs I didn't think was good or something. So
yeah, and occasionally, I mean, that won't work all the time, but I do that with some albums where it's not really clicking with me to start with. I think, oh, well, let's just try something different with it.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Okay. Now, after that tour, they had one of their tours happen, which was Somewhere Back in Time, and they were taking that all over the world, even to the remotest part of the world out there, which is the continent you live on. So, and you actually got to go to the show.
Oh, you'll never know how much we were cheering once this was announced. It was we'd given up on Iron Maiden. We just thought they were never going to come back.
Yeah.
They made it fairly clear that it was too expensive to come to Australia and New Zealand and these places because it was too far to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bruce puts his hand up and says, yeah, let's buy a plane and I'll fly it and we'll do it that way. And
yeah,
so they came out and it was just spectacular. It's still one of the great nights of my life. Mm-hmm. Again, all of my mates who I've spoken at different times through you that I went to school with that I'm still friends with today. We've got a group of about 10 blokes who all went through school together. and we still see each other twice a year. We get together for what we call the biannual, and we get together and have a drink and reminisce and that kind of stuff. And we all went to this concert together.
Ah, that's cool.
And we're on the floor at the Sydney I don't know what it was called in those days. It's Kudos Bank Arena now, but back in those days it wasn't called that. Mm-hmm. And we're on the floor, and they played every great song, and we jumped up and down, and we had our arms around each other, and we sang, and we drank, and it was just a fantastic night.
Now, even your friend that skipped the 1,000-seater show was there?
Yes, he was definitely still there.
Oh, wow. I guess I'm surprised I guess the bigger venues, maybe he was claustrophobic. You know, maybe that's why he didn't go to that night.
I'm sure he still got told about it that night. You know, you could have seen Iron Maiden back in 85.
Golly. Yeah, you could have seen when they – of course, you wouldn't have seen that show in a club. You would have seen, you know, just a raw version of Iron Maiden on stage, which would have been amazing too.
Correct, so, yes.
Well, at least he made it to that show. So
that's exactly right. And it was just fantastic. The band was on. It really was. It was just a fantastic night.
And that's really, I'll say it all serious, that's really, really cool that you've got this group of guys that you're still able to get and see, you know, once or twice a year, that you went to school with, that you've known your whole life. That's so cool. That is so cool. Yeah. Even the 1,000-seat skipper guy.
Even the 1,000-seat skipper, yep.
Oh, man. So I believe from here on out for the next couple of tours, well, so the next album came out eventually here, The Final Frontier, in 2010.
Yes.
And so you got to see that tour as well. So what did you think of the album and then, of course, the show?
The album I enjoyed a lot more straight away than I did A Matter of Life and Death. Again, that opening bit, Satellite 13, is that really necessary? But anyway, I really enjoyed this album, and I think, don't get me wrong, and there'll be people out there who know more about this kind of stuff than me, but I feel as though this album was more melodic than the previous one. Mm-hmm. The songs had more of that great Maiden melodic guitars than the previous album, and I think that everything came together on this. And then, as you say, we saw them on this tour again, because they got the plane back together, flight 666 again, and came to Australia again, and we thought, oh, this is good. We could see them every couple of years now, which hasn't been the case. But it was great. We, as it turns out, we were at a pub across the road drinking, and everyone went in for the support band, and we sort of said, we don't want to see the support, do we? Who is the support? Oh, I don't know. So we kept drinking, and then someone at some stage looked at his watch and sort of said, what time do Maiden come on? I said, oh, I think it's 9 o'clock. Why, what time is it? He said, it's 8:59.
Oh.
Right. So the only good thing about it was that we got in just as Satellite 13 finished, and they went bang and came onto stage with the Final Frontier. So we missed all the rubbish and just got the gold. And it was terrific. And actually, we were standing on the floor again, but we were standing up near the soundboard. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mate nudged me at one stage and said, look over there. And so about five people along from us, just standing with the side at the soundboard, was Rod Smallwood. And so we sort of all shouted out to him and waved, and he turned around and waved and gave us a thumbs up, and we thought, oh, well, there you go. We've been that close to Rod Smallwood. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but
I say it's a good thing. he's been with Iron Maiden longer than, well,
just about everyone.
Yeah, him actually, I think it's him and Steve Harris. Probably he's been there longer than Dave Murray, so
he's been around a long time. He's been very instrumental in the success.
Yeah, he's seen and done it all with them. So now you went and saw another show here in the time frame, and I found this one to be a really interesting one. This is the one thing that when I first read your email, I remember just thinking, holy crap, that's really cool. So you saw a show, I'm going to say it, in a certain way, and then you can tell the story. You saw an Iron Maiden show with three former singers of Iron Maiden. So why don't you tell us about this show?
Yeah, that was a bit out of the box, really. So I'd seen Paul Di'Anno. He came out, I think, 2 years before that on a solo tour, and he came out and he plays with a local band who support him, and he did all his famous Iron Maiden tracks. He actually did other stuff of his as well that night. He did Marshall Lockjaw from his Paul Di'Anno's Killers album. He did Children of Madness from Battlezone.
Marshall Lockjaw, anyway. That's like one of Matt's favorites, I think.
It's the best song he did on that album, but whether the comparison of everything else on that album was any good or not was interesting.
Let me ask, did he do Living in America by James Brown by chance?
He did not, thankfully. No, thankfully that was not in his set list at the time.
Oh, man, what a bummer.
So then 2 years later, he announced he's coming out again, but this time he was coming out with Blaze Bayley. So they were coming out on their, I can't remember exactly what they called it, but it was basically their Maiden's Greatest Hits tour. Yeah. So what they did was is that apparently they tossed a coin before each night, and whoever won the toss would go out first and do their era. So he came on, and Paul played the night that we saw him. He came out first, and then Blaze came out second. He did all his Iron Maiden songs, and it was just absolutely brilliant, really. Like, Paul at that stage sort of still had it. The local band were really good, and Blaze came out, but Blaze stole the show. He's such a showman, and it was just fantastic. Got the crowd going.
Yeah,
did all of his great Iron Maiden songs off those two albums, and it was just a joy to watch. So, I know the part you're alluding to. The other thing with that is, as Blaze does at the end of the show, he just came up and has a free meet and greet, which is just brilliant.
Yeah,
we went up, got my photo taken with him, which just, you know, I've still got on my phone as my screensaver.
Oh, cool.
And such an easygoing guy. And I sort of said to him at the time, I said, you're going to come to Australia and do your stuff? Because I really love his stuff. And he said, yeah, we're going to try and come out next year. And, of course, he hasn't because it's way too expensive, I'm sure, for him to do. But but anyway, so at the end of Paul's set, I'm pretty sure we must have had some inkling this was going to happen. He must have announced it beforehand. But he came to his last two songs and he said, all right, well, I've just been in contact with this guy up in Newcastle, and he's been living out here for 30 years, and he's going to come and do a couple of songs with us. And it was Paul Day, who was the very first singer for Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
Who emigrated to Australia, I think, in the mid-80s with his wife, and he's been living in Newcastle ever since. He still sings in a couple of cover bands in Newcastle. And he came out, and they did Iron Maiden and Running Free, and he did vocals with Paul Di'Anno on those last two songs. So, as you say, on that same night, we saw three former singers of Iron Maiden.
That is so cool because, I mean, you know, Paul Mario Day, whatever, his time in Maiden was what it was. And, you know, I've heard, I don't know if you ever listened to Talking Maiden. They did a little thing, and they did a really good thing about him being in the band and what his time was like. And, you know, and how he just didn't know what to be expected of him. You know, he didn't know how to be an epic frontman that Steve Harris wanted. And, of course, it was early on, but it's so cool because Steve Harris, I mean, the songs that, Paul Mario Day sang songs that were on the first two Iron Maiden albums with, you know, so it's like those are songs that were in his repertoire too, you know, so that's really cool that you got to see that though. I mean, because not many people can say that.
And I'll let you know, he could sing. He could still sing. And he sang those two songs better than Paul did.
I was about to say.
And I think that was the thing. He came out and sang. He'd obviously, you know, he's still been singing because he'd been singing in his other band. So it wasn't as if he'd come in cold. And he could still hit notes and whatever. And we sort of thought, wow, why hasn't this guy done more? But there you go.
He got
married and had a life instead.
That's cool. That's really cool. So Book of Souls, you know, it comes out and you get to go see that show. But that turns into a really special show for you.
Yeah, so Book of Souls came out, and again, that was an album that surprised me with how good it was and how much I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that more than I'd done the last two albums, in fact.
Okay.
Again, it's just simple things, I think, on that album too. Like, there's the short and sweet sort of Dickinson Smith songs that they used to do in the 80s that are on that album that sort of stand out straight at Speed of Light and Death or Glory.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the epic songs, If Eternity Should Fail, which is just such an amazing opening track. And seeing that live was just incredible as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got the last track, Empire of the Clouds, which, you know, is so out of place in everything Maiden have probably ever done. And sure. yet to me, it's one of the most epic things they've ever done. And I know that I've read somewhere, and my memory may fail me, but it was actually Nico who kicked Bruce in the butt all the time, every time he thought he was going to stop and whatever. He said, "Nope, keep going. I'm going to stay here. We're going to do this and whatever."
Mm-hmm.
And he was apparently, you know, really instrumental in that track being completed.
Very cool.
I'd sort of think sometimes you read, you know, that the writer is Bruce Dickinson, but from what I've read, and I can't remember where it was, but the fact that Nico was there doing all that kind of stuff, he probably deserves more credit for the fact that that song was done, let alone everything else he's done in the band.
Sure.
So, yes, so they toured again on this album, which was fantastic. But this time I got to take my then 8-year-old son, Josh, to see his first ever gig, which just happened to be an Iron Maiden gig.
Oh, nice.
And it was a really interesting gig. I think it was the Raven Age who opened for them. They'd come out as well, and then they opened for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went through Iron Maiden, and I'm sitting next to Josh, and then I've got my two of my other mates who are in that group of school friends who are sitting next mm-hmm. to us as well. And we're singing along and doing this, and Josh is just not moving at all, and he's just looking at the stage, and he's not sort of the whole show, not doing too much.
Sure.
And I was sitting there, I was thinking, I don't know if he's enjoying this or not. He's not really giving any reactions to anything. He's not sort of singing. I can use words to songs, he knew songs.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we got to the end and we were walking out, and my brother-in-law was there, and he turns around and he just says, "So what did you think of that, Josh?" And Josh just stopped and looked up at him and said, "That was the most amazing thing I have ever seen." And I just thought, thank goodness for that.
Oh, man, that's a great statement.
And then he didn't stop talking all the way home. It's about an hour and a half drive home. So we got in the car and he just talked about the show the whole way home. And I just thought, oh, well, that's a win.
Yes, absolutely. That's awesome.
And one of those things too is obviously this has a live album with it. And yeah. I can't remember if they had the speech that Bruce does before Blood Brothers.
Yeah.
But certainly that night he was talking about how I see lots of old people. I see lots of young people, and he says that obviously, you know, we've got old people here who are bringing their kids, and that their kids, some of their kids are bringing their kids, and he was going on all about, sorry, I'm getting a bit choked up just thinking about it.
That's all right.
And he was just basically saying that it's the big Iron Maiden family and that we are all blood brothers, and of course they go into Blood Brothers, and that was amazing.
Yeah, I know Matt brought his son to see Iron Maiden. We saw them in Denver, Colorado a couple years ago. And he said like months later that he started talking about, well, yeah, I have this family and my other family. And it was kind of a weird, like Matt was kind of like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, when we saw Iron Maiden, and Bruce said that if you're here, you're part of the family. When he told me that, I was just like, dude, that is so cool. So
absolutely.
Cool. And it's funny because as an adult, you think, like the whole speech about, you know, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or you're gay or straight or you're black or white or whatever your political beliefs are, blah, 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 blah. We're all family here. We're all one big, we're all here for the same reason. We're blood brothers. And it means a lot. It's cool. But like, when it resonates with a young kid, that tells you that it's how powerful it really is.
Yeah, and especially like I do it, you know, most metal shows that I go to, but especially that night, and Josh did mention that at later on. He said, just said, everyone was so friendly. Everyone was just there and you know, looking at your shirt. And if you'd see your shirt, say, oh, great shirt, dude, and all that kind of stuff. And and no one was aggressive. No one was, you know, up themselves or above themselves. Everyone was just there for a great time, and they treated everyone with respect. And not all metal shows are like that. And I think that's the kind of thing that Iron Maiden engenders through their music and what they stand for and all that kind of stuff. I just think it's a different show going to see Iron Maiden than it is any other band.
Yeah. That's one of the things that when I left, because I brought my kids to that show. That was their first Maiden show. My daughter has seen two Legacy of the Beast shows since then, but that's the only show my son went to. And I remember coming home because my wife was, she didn't want my kids to go because she's like, you know, it's this satanic blah, blah, blah thing, you know. She grew up really, you know, sheltered, so she just, whatever. But I remember her asking Sarah about it, and Sarah was just like, everybody was so nice, and all these people came up and kept telling me how cool my dad was that he had me in an Iron Maiden concert and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and as a parent when it's happening and you're at the show with your kid and you're hearing that and you're just like, man, this is awesome. But then when your kid goes home and tells, the only thing I did say was, okay, when we go home, you know that big blow up they had with the satanic looking skull for the number of the beast? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I go, don't mention that to mom, okay? I was like, everything else is okay. So that's awesome.
That's true. See, that's the thing with the Legacy of the Beast tour. Like, they were supposed to come to Australia, but it got cancelled because of COVID.
Yeah.
And I'd bought tickets for myself and my wife and my three kids to all go together because I just said everyone should see Iron Maiden once. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Josh already had. Mm-hmm. And my two daughters have been brought up with Iron Maiden. They know Iron Maiden. They don't necessarily listen to them.
Yeah.
And so I got cancelled, which was a shame. But, of course, they're coming to Australia later this year. So I'm taking Josh, of course, and also my eldest daughter, Jessica, is going to come. And she's, when I gave her the ticket for Christmas, I don't think I've seen her so excited for some time.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. That's good, man. That'll be great. That'll be great.
Yes.
So yeah, that really was a bummer, because I know Kirsty's talked about it forever. You know, I mean, that Legacy tour getting canceled. I know Andrew was planning on taking his son, and you know, I mean, of course, a lot of people got let down by that, and it does suck. I can't imagine it. I'm glad that I was on the right side of the world at least to get to see him at some
That's
point.
That's exactly right.
But they had this big build up for Senjutsu. We finally got Senjutsu, and it's the last album we have right now. And what did you think of that album? And obviously, you just told about your plans to go see the show. So,
yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? Where it basically came out of nowhere that I don't know how they kept it secret for so long they'd actually recorded this album.
Yeah,
And then it leaked. It wasn't that long before it was announced, was it? Maybe a week before that it was leaked and it said that it was going to come out. So that was really interesting. Obviously, COVID stuffed up their plans for that. But, this is another one. This is, for me, it's a little bit like A Matter of Life and Death. It's taken me a long time to get to the point that I actually get the album.
Mm-hmm.
The opening track, Nico's drumming on that opening track is the most amazing thing I've heard him play. The atmosphere that he creates in that song, to me, is the star attraction of that track. I cannot possibly fathom how he was able to come up with that beat to the song and make the song by doing that. That's a standout for me. Again, interesting when they go with The Writings on the Wall as the single they release with the video, because, again, that song is very different from what Iron Maiden's sound is like.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess for me, again, it's a little bit like A Matter of Life and Death, where the songs, I feel, are stretched. And, again, we've got the little interludes at the start and the finish and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So that plays on me a little bit. If I just put it on and I just listen to it, I don't have a problem with it. And if I sit down there and I decide I'm going to try and decipher it and work out how much I like it, then I get myself into a tizzy.
Yeah, sure.
So it was another one of those albums, I must admit, that I had built up way too much because I'd spent, I think I did on my Instagram at the time, every day, I had the 28 days of Iron Maiden leading up to the release of the album. So I listened to every one of their releases once a day and took a photo of me listening to it and all that kind of stuff. So I went from Iron Maiden to Killers to Maiden Japan. I did it all the way through. So every day of that 28 days, I listened to every Iron Maiden release and then got Senjutsu on the day it was released and put it on. And I think through all of that, I'd built it up way too much.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a new Maiden album, and it was all those years later, and it reminded me of, I want to get to another point, but, you know, I think there was a point recently in the last, I think, I'm not a big Metallica fan anymore, but I think when they released their last album, it literally just dropped one day, and they were like, yeah, our new album's out tomorrow, kind of thing. But when you, I mean, it's a new Maiden album, and we didn't know we were going to get it, it's like, all of a sudden these little hints start happening and next thing you know, it's like, holy crap, something big is about to happen.
Yes.
But I meant to ask you this, whenever you went through and you listened to all that, you had your whole buildup, which version of Somewhere in Time were you listening to? Were you listening to the one with or without Sea of Madness? Cause I mean, it's well known out there that you're not a big fan of that song.
It absolutely is. Yes. Thankfully my cassette player no longer works and I no longer have that version of Somewhere in Time. So I listened to my vinyl version and I just flipped over the album when I got to the end of side one and listened all the way through.
There you go. Okay. So I got one more question for you. And I know if you've ever heard an Iron Maiden story, you might know what the last question is, but it's like a 17 part question.
Correct.
So, let's see here. And depending on how well-versed you think you are, you can do best and worst or just best.
Very good.
So I think you're well-versed. So I think, you know, like, whereas I think Matt is a fan, I think you're more of an expert. So, but, and probably many, many facets of life, Matt is just a fan.
I'm going to stay out of that argument.
Yeah. So, okay. So, we'll go album by album and I'll name the album. You tell me your favorite song first. And obviously on Somewhere in Time, you don't have to mention Sea of Madness. So.
Yes.
But then the second song will be the least favorite. So here we go. We'll start off with the self-titled Iron Maiden album. What you got?
I think Phantom of the Opera is the standout. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Sure. I think Beyond That, Strange World is a really beautiful song too that doesn't get mentioned as much. If you want to go with worst song, again, I wouldn't call it the worst song, but I think Charlotte the Harlot is the one that you'd consider to be of that standard.
We'll call it, if you want to call it, we can call it the least best.
Yes, that's probably the best way to go.
Okay. So what about Killers?
The favorite song is really difficult because there are three great songs on there. If I had to nominate one, it would be Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Okay.
Close second would be Killers and Purgatory. I love Purgatory. Okay. Probably the least best song on the album, I guess, is I'm going to say Innocent Exile, and I'll take the barbs of everyone who want to take that to me, but I had to choose one.
Wow. Okay. Hey, you know, this is your list though. I'm not going to fight with anybody on it. You know, I don't have to agree, but you know, that's okay.
No, that's correct.
That's what makes it interesting here. So, The Number of the Beast is next.
Yes. Again, these are all difficult, aren't they? My favorite song is The Prisoner, by far. I just think it's a fantastic track.
Okay.
Least favorite, in quotation marks, is Ganglands.
Okay.
Or Ganglands, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Peace of Mind is next.
Peace of Mind is almost impossible. Look, the song that got me into Iron Maiden was Flight of Icarus.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got those two cassettes and I listened to those albums over and over for 6 weeks, the song that finally triggered me into Iron Maiden was Flight of Icarus. I'm a bit of a, I like history, I like ancient history, Greek mythology, stuff like that. So that sort of, that grabbed me, I guess, is the best way to put it. But on, you can't go past The Trooper. The Trooper is probably the most amazing song ever written by any band, I would suggest.
It's very iconic.
It doesn't matter that, you know, these days it might feel a bit tired hearing because you've heard it 4,000 million times. But as a song, I don't think you can go past The Trooper as the best on that album. Least favourite, I guess, is going to be the same for most people. It would be Quest for Fire, but only because I have to choose one.
I mean, I should have just said, what's the most god-awful song on the album? You could have picked Quest for Fire, so yeah. All right, so the next album is Power Slave.
Again, as anyone would know, trying to choose a favourite off this album is almost impossible. I would go with Power Slave, the song. I think it's just a fantastic song. And that middle interlude bit, the solo bit where Steve's bass just runs the way through, like his bass line through that is just amazing. And then the two solos over the top is just incredible. Least favourite, really? Do I have to pick one?
Good luck.
You know, it doesn't matter what you choose. Everyone, there's someone out there, or most people are going to say, you're an idiot. So I'm going to say, for fear of all retribution, Lost for Words.
Yeah. That's the easy choice because there's no.
It's exactly right. Yeah.
And like you said, there's really no bad song on that album. So there's no easy.
I agree. I could say that Power Slave is my favorite album of all time.
Okay.
From anyone, so.
Okay. So what about Somewhere in Time?
Somewhere in Time. Do you want the Sea of Madness answer, or would you like a different one?
I definitely want the Sea of Madness answer, whichever you got. It's included. Right, it's got to be included in one way or the other.
My favorite song on the album is Sea of Madness. Again, I just think there is so much that is great about that song, and the fact that, like, Adrian wrote a lot of songs on this album because Bruce was not in a position to. I often wonder if Bruce had been involved, would Sea of Madness been written at all? And I think what a travesty that would have been. Again, least favourite song, I'm going to go with the other one that everyone thought was the one, which is Deja Vu. Not, again, because I think it's a bad song, because indeed, I think when I first got the album, it was actually my favourite on the album. But over time, it has developed to be the least favorite best.
Have you ever heard of the official detention teacher?
I have. I've heard you mention him often.
His favorite Iron Maiden song is Deja Vu. So if you end up in detention anytime soon, when he hears this, you're going to end up in detention.
I'm going to be in detention. There's no doubt about it. Again, I put my hands up and say, I had to choose one, sir.
He won't be the happiest man in podcast land that day. Oh, gosh. So what about Seventh Son?
Again, almost impossible. I think the title track is my favorite. It's just epic. It's a fantastic song. Here's another one. How do you choose a least favorite on this? You know what? I'm going to have to go with The Prophecy, but I don't like saying that at all.
I could easily pick two off this album.
Yep.
Yeah. One of them was the first single.
Yes.
That's easily my number one least favorite on that album.
Yeah. Oh, I know a lot of people have a problem with that song. I don't know. I've just always enjoyed it. Yeah.
I've always liked it, but I always think that the live version of it ruins it for me. It is not made to be played live. So
I 100% agree with that. Yeah, yes. They should not have done that.
What about No Prayer for the Dying?
Yeah, my favorite, running against a lot of people, I think, is Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter.
Okay.
I actually bought the cassette to A Nightmare on Elm Street or five or whatever it was when the original version was on that soundtrack. There was also an Alice Cooper song on that soundtrack. There was a couple of other bands. So I thought, I'm going to buy it. And it was cheap. I think it was about $3 or $4 in those days. And I bought it and loved that version of the song from the start. And then realized they were putting it on this album. And I just thought, well, that's fantastic. So that was great. Least favorite. Gee whiz. Whatever I say again, people are not going to like. I'm going to go with Public Enema number one.
Whoa.
It's, again, I put my hands up again. I had to choose one. Yeah. I don't know what else to say, Steve.
Wow, man. That is not what I would have expected. I think you need to go back when you get done and listen to that song. And then you are going to ask me to re-record this episode.
If I just record a little bit, can you paste it over the top?
Yeah, I'll paste in Hooks in You whenever you get done listening to that album.
I love Hooks in You. I think it's a fantastic song. I know a lot of people don't, but I love the attitude of that song.
What I'm guessing here is that Matt must have sent you a bag of peanuts or something.
Not on this occasion, but yes, that's...
He'll owe you one then. Oh, gosh. Okay, so now the next one's going to be really difficult. For both reasons, Fear of the Dark, what's your favorite and what's the worst?
This is probably the easiest album to choose, to be honest. My favorite song is Judas Be My Guide. It's...
Excellent.
Yeah. I love the title track Fear of the Dark, and mm-hmm. it's become tired over the years because they do it at every live album, they do it all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you listen, and when you listen to Live at Donington and you hear the version they do on that, mm-hmm. it sounds fresh and it sounds brilliant. Mm-hmm. And that's my favorite version of this song because it's not tired, it doesn't feel like it's being forced like it does now. Mm-hmm. And because it's on that tour, and it just sounds terrific on that album to me. That's my favorite version of that song.
Gotcha.
But still, Judas Be My Guide is my favorite, and Wasting Love is probably one of the worst songs ever written.
I will say this, Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, the version, the live version of that on that Donington, I really enjoyed the audience participation part, you know, where he's got them, bring your daughter, fetch your daughter. I was like, because they were singing so loud, I was like, that's really cool. I did enjoy that.
Yes, so. And it is. It's a crowd participation song.
What about the X Factor?
The X Factor is difficult. My favorite song is The Edge of Darkness. I love that song. And, I mean, I do love the movie Apocalypse Now and that whole monologue at the start, which is obviously the opening to this song as well.
Yeah.
And I think that Blaze sings this just beautifully. I think it's just a perfect song for his voice. Mm-hmm. And I think his performance on this song is one of his best in Iron Maiden. So that's always been my favorite song of the album. Sign of the Cross is the other one. I guess they're the two epics on the album. But for me, The Edge of Darkness has been. Least favorite, it's probably Fortunes of War. Okay. I feel that plods along a bit, and it's probably overlong. I probably could have done something better with that.
Gotcha there. All right, now I'm really curious to hear what your choice on Virtual 11 is going to be. Because you mentioned you liked about half of it and you didn't like half of it, so I'm wondering which half. Well, okay, you know what? Yeah, this isn't going to be that difficult. I got it. Go ahead. Now that I think, go ahead. Go to God.
Yeah, again, it's the easiest one. The Klansman is the number one song on the album.
Okay.
It's a Steve Harris classic, and everything about it is fantastic. I do think probably Bruce sings this better in the live versions than Blaze sings it, but it's almost made for Bruce on stage, isn't it, this song with freedom and getting the crowd involved.
Sure.
But I've always loved the Klansman. And The Angel and the Gambler is right up there with Wasting Love as one of the worst songs ever written.
Yeah, I kind of figured that's where I started thinking, well, which song is he going to... Oh, never mind. All right, so now it gets... this will be interesting. Brave New World.
Yes. My favorite song is a tough one. it's a tough one, all right. I think... I have to go with The Wicker Man.
Okay.
And I think, as I said earlier, because it was that first song with the return of Adrian and Bruce and that the opening riff is Adrian, and just everything about it, I think, was just the return of Iron Maiden. So that's still a favourite. Ghost of the Navigator and Blood Brothers are both brilliant as well. Mm-hmm. The thin line between love and hate for me is probably my least favourite. I could have easily said The Nomad, but no, I'm going to go with The Thin Line Between Love and Hate.
Wow. Oh my. I one time said that Nomad, Thin Line Between, Out of the Silent Planet and Thin Line could possibly be the best 1, 2, 3 songs in a row on any Maiden album ever.
Yep.
God, you just said Nomad and, God.
I'll agree with the middle one. I think Out of the Silent Planet's a terrific song.
Oh, man. Okay, well, I'll have to... I'll have
again,
to...
again, it's least favorite. It's not terrible.
I just need to move on here. Let's see. What about Dance of Death?
Dance of Death, again, it's got a number of songs that could easily be there. I've got to go with Passchendaele. It's slightly in front of Face in the Sand. Both of them are just fantastic songs. And you know, Rainmaker, to me as well, is just a brilliant song. Mm-hmm. Least favourite's got to be Wildest Dreams. I just think it's a bit formulaic, I think, is the way I would put it.
Okay.
I think all the other songs on that album, they have something about them that is different.
Okay. Fair enough. I can't disagree with those choices there. What about A Matter of Life and Death?
Yeah, this is tough. I think the favourite track is similar to what most people think, which is For the Greater Good of God, which I am eternally disappointed I didn't get to see live. Beyond that, you know what? I'm going to go for the opening track again, Different World. Again, I just think that as an opening track from a Maiden album, it didn't stand up.
Okay.
And I thought the songs beyond that were really good, whereas I just don't know that Different World sets up the album in the way it needs.
Yeah, me and Matt were reading through that song, I want to say a while back, we were reading through some of the lyrics on it, and it really, it sets the album up in a weird way. But it is, it's definitely, if I had to pick the weakest song on the album, I liked that song, but I would definitely say everything else from there on is like just a stronger piece of all put together. So
absolutely. Stronger writing, stronger performance.
Yeah. So next up you have The Final Frontier.
The Talisman is one of my favorite Maiden songs of the last 25 years. I never get sick of listening to it. And I still get is it shivers down the spine when he gets to the end, in the last probably 2 minutes of that song, and Bruce is just singing at the top of his voice, and just I feel it coming out into me, and I sort of think, wow, this is just amazing. And the whole story of the song, and I'm seeing it basically as he's singing the song, and I'm just thinking, this is just amazing. So to me, The Talisman is the standout for that album. Do I go with another controversial one? Probably. When the Wild Wind Blows is the one that I'll go for as the weakest song on the album. It's... as a closing song, and I know Nico loves it and all that kind of stuff, but it doesn't do it for me.
I did an episode a long time ago, and I think it was the worst of Bruce Dickinson.
Yep.
And I picked one song off every Bruce album that I just thought, you know, the least, best, whatever. And I'm pretty sure that was what I picked. So.
Yes, right.
So let's see. Next up, we have The Book of Souls.
Yeah. I do have three or four there that I could call. I'm going to have to go with Eternity Should Fail. Okay. Again, just a great way to open the album, mm-hmm. a great way to open the concert. And I think Bruce's performance on that is just fantastic. I know that a lot of people don't like the Red and the Black, and I don't understand that because that would probably be my next choice. But in this case, it's not. Yeah. What am I going to go here? I don't know.
I've got my bet in.
I think the weakest song is probably Tears of a Clown.
Okay.
But I, you know what? I'm not really sure. That's the one I'd have to go with.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of what I was thinking, but then I was thinking I did an episode a while back where I definitely picked a different song. So that's the weakest song. So, and lastly, the last album, Senjutsu, what do you got?
Well, I do think that Senjutsu, the opening track, is my favorite. And again, as I just said, Nico's drumming on that track to me is just outstanding.
Yeah.
And that to me is the highlight of the song. It's just fantastic. Weakest, I would. How much trouble am I going to get in saying this? I'm going to say Days of Future Past.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. Interesting.
This is coming from the guy who says that a lot of the songs are overblown, and yet he's picked the shortest song on the album.
I mean, all things considered, this is a guy that hates Sea of Madness still.
That's right. So what does he know anyway?
Yeah. I mean, he hangs out with guys that skip seeing the Power Slave era in a small club, you know. Come on.
Pretty much. As my son Josh would say, what would you know, Dad?
Yeah, exactly. That's what they would all say to us. So. Oh, man. Well, that was good, man. Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate you taking the time because, A, it's taken a lot of time out of your day to sit in here and talk and everything. But, man, it's a lot of enjoyable stuff to listen to and just talk about. And I really appreciate it. So thank you for coming on, sending your story in and doing this. I appreciate it.
Well, can I just say, Steve, that it might have taken some time in a day, but it's one of the things I enjoy most is – talking about music and especially mm-hmm. talking about Iron Maiden. I mean, I couldn't have thought of a better way to spend my Saturday afternoon than sitting here talking to you about this. It's just been brilliant. And I appreciate what you do and the podcast and everything that you and Matt and Kirsty do on it. I think it's fantastic. It's it certainly fills in my Wednesdays and Thursdays listening to each episode. So
very cool.
Keep going, and I'm enjoying every moment of it.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And for anyone out there, again, go to Spotify. I believe the top two money earners there are Joe Rogan and Bill Peters. I think he's somewhere behind you. You're definitely somewhere behind him.
I'm definitely somewhere behind number one. Yes.
Yeah. So if you go to Spotify, look up Music from a Lifetime. I've been listening. I was telling him before we started recording all this and all the different episodes that I've got saved, and he covers tons of different bands, many bands that I've covered as well. So I really was like, let me see what he thinks of this band and that band and kind of, and what I've heard so far, we agree a lot. We disagree a little bit, but we probably agree a lot more than we disagree. So all that said, again, thank you very much, sir.
Cheers, Steve. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And the fate is moving and the finger points to you. He knocks you to your